welcome in, everyone, to Evening Concert.
I love this stuff.
Not really. Well, I've got, this is a QSO Live to introduce the show. I've got David with me, KG4WXW.
Good evening.
And you like that?
I do.
That's Raymond Lefevre, a lost sound for today, I guess. That's called Soul Coaxing. I always liked that song. Anyways, but that's not what this is all about. This is about amateur radio and shortwave radio and all those kind of things. And we just came off of what I consider to be probably one of the most successful field day broadcasts we have ever had in the history of doing field day. And what we have with us now is a guest that is part of a special event station. And that happens to be Jim. And Jim, I'm going to let you, it's KB0QNW. And he's part of the Roswell, New Mexico, I guess I want to say amateur radio organization. Actually, they have a different name, but everybody knows where Roswell is, or at least they've heard of it before. And before we came on tonight, I just told everyone we're going to be talking to Jim in Roswell, New Mexico, with their group. And the whole deal is, though, is that you know, we wouldn't have cell phones today if it weren't for Roswell. So,
could very well be.
So, how are you doing, and what's happening out there? Tell us about the special event station going on.
Well, Ted, we're doing real good. We're kind of going down and making some. We kind of went down and did some operational checks today. We put a radio on our G5RV that's on the roof of the International UFO Museum and Research Center, and we went down to put a radio on it and make sure that it would tune still and everything was good to go. Made a couple of contacts, that kind of thing, and just getting really excited about it. Kind of neat, you know. It's going to be our first special event station, and here for our club, the Pecos Valley Amateur Radio Club is actually the full name of it. But anyway, we're getting really excited about it. First time we've done this at the prompting of our Aries. Let me get him right. He's our section emergency manager, I do believe, Jay Miller, and he said he's going to be listening tonight. So I got to get his title right. But yeah, we're really excited about it. It's quite the phenomenon here in Roswell, as most people know, and we're just proud to be a part of it.
Well, you know, I think it's cool because one of the things that makes it cool also is when you have a special event station coming from an area that people are really familiar with, plus the fact, obviously, Roswell has with it that mystique, you know, of the crashed UFO. Of course, now we were told that the contents of that and the aircraft and everything was taken immediately to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base up in Ohio, which is right near Dayton, okay? So right in Dayton, you know. So kind of makes me wonder if some of those Dayton amateurs don't also have, you know, kind of an inside scoop to this thing, you know. Maybe that's why.
Well, yeah, and actually the folks in the Fort Worth area, too, around what's by today known as Carswell Air Force Base, that was also actually a first hop, I believe, before they actually went on to Wright-Patt. I've been kind of trying to brush up on the history myself, but the way I understand is Jesse Marcel, you know, he was the Jesse Marcel Sr. was an intelligence officer with the Roswell or the Army Air Force at the time, and the first hop was actually into what's now Carswell Air Force Base, and he took a lot of the debris over there initially. Now they might have taken the bodies on the Wright-Patt. And some of the debris, I'm not sure just how that whole timeline went. But, yeah, the folks around Fort Worth have a kind of a stake of interest in this as well.
I noticed you said they took the bodies, you know, and you say that rather matter of fact. Okay, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like we were talking Tuesday. It's like there's an awful lot of evidence out there that something significant happened that night, July 4th, back in 1947. As to just what the origin of that significant event was is left to I guess, anyone's conclusions. But there's an awful lot of convincing evidence that it was extraterrestrial. And, I mean, you know, also, although there was really, I guess, one story. See, and here's even where I'm confused. There was either one report said two crafts crashed over the Brazel Ranch, and one went on to crash 200 miles away, which contained the bodies that were ejected from the vehicle. And the debris field on the Brazel Ranch northwest of Roswell was the other one. I've also heard it that something catastrophic happened to the crash or to the craft as it was coming in toward the earth, and the debris field on the Brazel Ranch was part of it, and then the crash of that one craft, and then the craft went on to crash a couple hundred miles later. But, you know, I like I said, I've got to go back and research. Actually, maybe two accounts, stories. I'm not really sure.
Well, the guy that's the real expert on this, and it would be a real interesting thing to get him on and talk with you and anybody else there that is part of it, and that is Stanton Friedman. Are you familiar with him at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was watching him being interviewed on a video that's been around. Yeah, he's quite the...
If you go back into our podcast section of QSL Radio Show, in the very beginning you will find, I think, maybe two of the shows that Stanton did with us. And, you know, he's a no-nonsense guy. You know, he really is. Uh-huh. He's not, you know... I mean, you hear these people that are on late-night radio, and, man, I mean, they can cook up some stuff, you know, and... But it's interesting listening. I mean, I have to say that some of the most interesting listening things. Matter of fact, I've got another group that we did a show with that the heaviest downloaded podcast when we were doing podcast. And our podcasts, by the way, are going to resume. We're very close to having all of them come back up. And at some point in time, I'll explain the reason as to why we stopped doing them for a while. But the most heavily downloaded podcast was a group out of Ohio, ham radio group that were ghost hunters, and they used spectrum analyzers and all kinds of things that the guys on these ghost TV shows haven't even thought of yet, you know. And it was hit hard. I hear people say, well, you know, you need to be concentrating just strictly on ham radio, you know. But the thing of it is that hams are the most diversified group of people as far as interests are concerned. I mean, hams are, you know, really think about this. Most of them are introverts until they get behind a microphone. You know, and they have such diverse interests. You go up and down the bands. It used to be, I don't know, maybe it's not like that today, but you go up and down the bands, and there were nets about everything, every subject on the planet. There was a net on ham radio covering it, you know. And so I think that's the reason why. And I think also the popularity of Art Bell. Art, who is probably one of the most dedicated amateur radio operators. You know, you take one look at his ham shack and you can tell the man has an obsessive compulsive thing going for ham radio, you know. And all the subject matter on his late night shows, and even his successor, even on her shows, it's the same subject material, and people. I mean, it's, you know, to some degree, yes, it's facts and numbers, and people are intrigued by it. But on the other hand, some of it is strictly theater of the mind. And and that makes it very, very entertaining. So that's why I think, you know, so you're doing a special event station. You're in Roswell, New Mexico. You are over the top of, now what is the building or the place, the museum?
Well, it's the International UFO Museum and Research Center. It's located at 114 North Main Street in Roswell. It's right downtown Roswell. Our main crossroads of US 380 and US 70 and 285 all take place right at 2nd and Main. And the building is just that first block to the south of that intersection. It was an old movie theater Plains Movie Theater. So you'll see the marquee and the riser sign that goes up, which is, by the way, where we have our G5 RV tied to, and then it runs the length of the building. But, you know, we put a junior up there because we didn't think that building, we were told that building was shorter than it was, but we could have put a full-length G5 RV up there. There's that much room. But anyway, that's point is, it's the movie theater right downtown Roswell, and you can't miss it, really. It's quite noticeable right there at the heart of Roswell, New Mexico, right down.
So now all the guys that are out there now that could, I guess, get on the air and work you as a special event station. Why don't you tell us what your what frequency you're operating on and the times that you guys are running? I mean, are you running around the clock? Or are you on a schedule of some sort?
No, we're operating out of the museum, which has 9 to 5 local hours. That's Mountain Daylight Time. So we'll be there from 9 to 5 Mountain Daylight Time, which is, let's see, we're six hours Zulu minus 6. So you can do that math. But it's 9 to 5 Mountain Daylight Time, and we will be there on 14.245 megahertz. That's plus or minus 10, and that's our for sure frequency we're going to park on. Now, we're also going to have a second station up on 40 meters. I get them mixed up. Yeah, 40 meters, 7 point, whatever, you know, the other one. But we'll also have a secondary station there also. We're not quite sure where we're going to be on that one right yet. But yeah, we'll be there from July 1st through July 4th. So we'll be 4 days during the festival, 9 to 5.
Well, let's ask this question: the second station that's operating, what kind of an antenna are you going to have for it?
Well, we're going to run a fan dipole that one of our club members built, Dan Musgrave, WD8RMG, and we operated that antenna during field day, and it was just it exceeded expectations. It just did a terrific job. So we're really looking forward to having it on as well as our
I think your fan dipole watch this now, here I go, because I'm not politically correct. I think the fan dipole is going to eat the G5 RV's lunch. Okay,
it may do it. The only difference it might, or the only hampering, that's a word anyway, that it might have would be the fact that it's going to be lower. The G5 RV is on the roof. Now, maybe we should have put the fan dipole up there, but it's the fan dipole is going to be down pretty close to the ground, of course, above where anybody can get any physical touch to it. But it may do it. It just may do it.
The G5 RV, from my own personal experience, is really poor on 75 and 80 meters. I mean, it's like a dummy load. But on the higher frequencies, they do okay. I mean, if you keep it up around, 20 meters or whatnot, you'll be fine. That fan dipole do much better on 40. And so I hope you guys just get all kinds of contacts. Now, we'll try to continue to pass word along as to where you're going to be. So any exact frequencies that you are going to be operating on, like, say, for example, 40 and whatnot, let me know, because as the week progresses, we will make those announcements. And I'll also pass the word along to Bob Heil and Don Wilbanks and the gang over there at Ham Nation, so they can kind of give you a plug. Give you a plug too, that way you get a bunch of contacts, you know. So I think that's fun. I think it is so much fun doing a special event station from a location like that. Now, we did a broadcast. This was just really impromptu. Mm-hmm. We went to the National Association of Broadcasters, and I'm going to replay this thing because it was so sudden. It was like, it came upon us like, we were out there in Las Vegas, and a very good friend of ours, David and Matt, my two sons, had gone out to Area 51 2 years in a row, and that was without me. The third year I went out to the NAB, which I didn't attend it those 2 years, but I went out the next year. And when I did, I said, well, if you guys are going out to Area 51, I'm going. So I went. And It was a spectacular thing. They sat there with their 35-millimeter cameras. I say 35-millimeter. They're digital SLRs today with Magic Lantern software on them. You know, it's interesting because when I first got a digital camera, I used to really have fun with them because we'd get ready to go somewhere and say, you need to stop off at the drugstore because I got to get some film.
Yeah.
And they give me this look, you know, like, oh, boy. But I do that frequently. A lot of times I'll tell a story more than once just to make them think that, I'm getting way out there in the fog, you know. And
I used to tell people, I used to make a joke and tell people I had a photographic memory, but my problem is I'm always out of film. But you say that to anyone today, they just look at you like, what are you talking about?
What? Yeah, there you go. Okay, turn your radio up loud. Have you got it up loud right now? Alexa, play WTWW. Oh, yeah, listen, let me tell you something. You can listen on Alexa, and that's all you have to do is say, Alexa, play WTWW, and you have us in your home, and you don't need a shortwave radio. You don't need a computer or a laptop or anything. Alexa does a fine job. So join us on Alexa by saying, Alexa, play WTWW. Let me tell you a little bit about the ICOM IC7610. This is a high-performance RMDR receiver, transceiver. This thing will pick out the faintest of signals, even in the presence of stronger adjacent signals. And the 7610 is a direct sampling software-defined radio, and it's going to change the world's definition. That's the ICOM 7610. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/amateur. That's ICOMAmerica.com/amateur.
You know, there are very few hobbies that can stick around for a century. But amateur radio is one of the growing survivors, with about 3 million currently active hams worldwide. Most of us know about the public service aspect of our hobby and how we can help neighbors by providing emergency communications. It works when nothing else does. But there's more to it than that. Hams are part of a worldwide community that spread goodwill with some of the nicest, smartest, and most interesting people that you'll ever meet. Of course, you know, it's easy to interest people in ham radio, but then there's that pesky test. And for many, that's a big stop sign. Those technical questions might as well be a foreign language to a newcomer. And frankly, a lot of the teaching tools aren't very good. But now, thankfully, there's a game changer. It's called Ham Test Online, and it turns the gobbledygook into something that's pretty easy to understand, and that makes getting licensed really easy. And not only is it inexpensive, but it comes with a 100% money-back guarantee. You get your ticket, or you get your money back. And in a recent independent study of new hams, 97% gave Ham Test Online 5 stars. So if you've been putting off getting your license, no problem. Maybe you're a technician wanting to upgrade to general or extra. No problem. Try it right now. The first 50 questions are free. Your success is guaranteed. Try it out right now. www.hamtestonline.com. That's www.hamtestonline.com. You'll be really glad you did.
If you enjoy listening to shortwave at home, you'll enjoy it even more in the car. You can get away from the dull, boring AM/FM stations and listen to something really cool on shortwave in your car with Car Shortwave Radio. Their website is carshortwaveradio.com. A small, inconspicuous antenna mounts either on your trunk or on your hood, plugs into the cigarette lighter, comes in on your car radio, and you can read the frequency out on your car radio dial. You control it all with a little key fob. It's slick. It makes your car radio sound like a Wurlitzer jukebox when you're listening to WTWW. Go to carshortwaveradio.com. That's carshortwaveradio.com. Once again, go to carshortwaveradio.com, and you'll be glad that you did. So anyways, this year was really cool. we went out we started talking about doing this broadcast from Area 51. And another ham friend of ours, Brian Kirkin, and I can't remember his call sign right off the bat because we basically converse either on the telephone or in person. But anyways, he's actually the chief engineer for WMUZ in Detroit, and he's there. He used to be with Telos, Omnia Telos, that make all the processors and the consoles like the one we're running right now. Anyways, he says, well, you know what? He says, my buddies over here have a satellite truck. Why don't we get them to go? So he goes and he talks to them, and he gets them signed up for Insanity. And off we go. Mike Erickson from Wheatstone, and Steve, I'm trying to think of who all else was there. What's Steve's last name again?
Dove.
Dove, Steve Dove.
Yep, Steve Dove.
And he was there. This fellow is a designer. He designed the M1 mic processor and the Air Aura broadcast processor, which is probably one of the most foremost sounding audio processors for FM today. Well, anyways, we all packed up and went. Now, the year before, there were all these folks there, but mostly engineers, and we went out, and they were clowning around. And they, what was it? Hans, the fellow from the Netherlands that does Stereo Tools, said that he wanted to do a sick movie.
Yeah.
So a sick, really bad movie.
Yeah, that's a really bad one.
Out there. So they staged it, and I don't know. Who was it that came out of the woods and...
They were all running around.
I know, but it was, I mean, I had to put it up on the web. It was really funny. They had more fun. I mean, everybody's laughing so hard. Good Lord. So anyways, we go out to do this broadcast, and they set up the satellite truck. They actually beat us when we got there. And I've got to still get more information from these satellite guys because they've got a unique service. There's all kinds of people, I think, that could use what they do. But they were set up, man. We had internet. I mean, we had internet. And... We set up and we started feeding the transmitter. I'm on the air and I'm talking, and all of a sudden, I hear all these guys. Now this is a group of radio engineers, okay, and hams, and they're outside the truck. And all of a sudden, they're all screaming and yelling. You know, and I thought, oh my God, what is happening? You know, I thought maybe these guys from Area 51 hit them with a death ray or something. I mean, I just didn't know what it was. You know. And a few minutes later, Mike Erickson was in the vehicle. I said, Mike, go out there and check this out, because it was so loud. It was coming in through the microphone. I was in a van doing the broadcast, satellite truck parked beside me, and all these guys are outside. David laying on the on your back on the ground, okay? And, so Mike gets up, and Mike goes outside. And I'm thinking, he'll be back in a minute. He'll tell me what's going on. And the next thing I know, I hear Mike screaming, okay? And I thought, man, we are in trouble. So I'm sitting there just trying to ad-lib my way through the situation, not having any idea what was going on. Why don't you, I'll say this. When somebody finally came back to the vehicle, they said the reason why they were screaming, because up in the sky, directly overhead, it looked like the sky was on fire. It looked like there was actual flames, you know, in the sky. I mean, that sounds like Revelation out of the Bible or Armageddon starting or something. You know, I mean, I never heard of such a thing. And that's why they were all crazy. You know, you were laying on your back.
I was. I go out there to stargaze. I've got my binoculars with me. And, you know, I'm out there just watching. You know, so and I found myself a nice little spot. You know, it was like in a little depression. That way the wind wouldn't be hitting me. You know, and I could just lay there and be comfortable because it is. It's cold out there in the desert.
Oh, so, man, you know, it was really cold.
Yeah.
So what was it when they were screaming? What was it you were seeing?
It was crazy lights that were just going nuts in the sky. I mean, just straight above us. You know, there was no sound, nothing. You know, you couldn't see any aircraft. You just saw these flames that were up there, and they were high up in the air. It was just wild. You know, some of the things we've seen.
Was it disrupting your communications?
No.
No, we kept a solid signal the whole time, didn't we?
Yeah. There was nothing nothing like that. And you know, the van didn't rise up in the air, and you know, we didn't see any cows floating around or anything like that.
Right. Well, how close were you to? I'm curious. How close were you to the perimeter, if you will, where the signs, those ominous signs, trespassers will be shot on sight or whatever, and the, you know, the four-wheel drive vehicles with the gentlemen with, you know, fully automatic weapons slung over their back and everything. How close were you to that situation? Did you see anybody checking you out, eyeballing you or anything?
Now, you know, we were on the side of, you know, we could see the, you know.
You can see all those guys.
Yeah. I mean, when you.
Oh, you could.
Yeah, with the binoculars, you can see the vehicles driving back and forth on the hill over there doing their, you know, doing their perimeter checks.
Right.
You know, we've never pushed it that far, getting that close, you know, to where we can start seeing the signs and, you know, okay. And military.
Well, I mean, we're close. Where we are, there are no signs.
Right.
And there probably would be if you went up closer to the fences and followed the fences, you probably would see signs. But the spot where we're at, there's a gap in signs. You don't see them, you know. But now, what was weird is the year before, though, when we got ready to leave, there was aircraft that went over and actually shined some horrendous-looking spotlight down on us, you know, and it lit up the whole. It looked like daylight outside, you know.
Right.
And they went over, and it was silent, totally silent. Didn't hear a peep out of it, you know. So,
wow,
you know. Now, what I did is I took this stance. And I'll still take this stance, you know. Whether the stuff out there is alien or not, I don't believe matters because it's on our government property, which means that somehow we're hooked in, okay? So if it's our technology or if it's technology that we've acquired, I don't, you know, who knows? But
yeah,
what really struck me is I thought, we have access to whatever this is, and it's unearthly looking. I mean, I was sitting in the seat. I couldn't see anything, obviously, as in a van, but there was one display that went on that I could see out of the front of the van. And, I mean, it gave me chills because this object appeared that was, oh, I don't know, looked about the size of a half a dollar in the sky. And it was divided up into sections. You could see the sections. And then you could see like this, these two, like a pie, you know, but it lit from the left, and then the lights went around it all the way to the right, and then poof, it was gone, and then it reappeared in the sky, you know, a little distance later, and then poof, it was gone. Then that was followed by something, I don't even know how to describe this. Holly said it looked like a UFO or an object rotating with lights on. To me, we counted seven lights. And how it happened is light number one came on, then it went out, two came on, it went out, three came on, all the way up to number seven, and then the object vanished. And it was pretty good size, you know. And
this is after the big fiery light occurred right above you, or...
Well, yeah. This was shortly after that. And what happened is my son Matt came over, and somebody told him, and I don't know who it was. He had an email earlier, because when you're out there, you don't get any email because there's no internet of any kind. There's no cell service of any kind.
Yeah, you can't even hit a ham repeater from there.
Yeah, you can't hit a ham repeater. I mean, you scan the AM and FM dial, you don't even hear a radio station anywhere. So, but our signal out there in the desert is loud. I mean, we're coming in, you know, how would you say?
It sounds like
30, 40 over 9 solid, you know.
Sounds like a local station.
And, but what was interesting was somebody had got word to him that inside of the Area 51 complex that they were listening to us, you know, and I was thinking, you know, is that like a recreational listen, or is this an investigative listen? You know, who knows, you know?
Right.
So anyhow, he comes over to the van and picks up the mic, and he said, well, if you guys inside there are listening, he said, why don't you, do something so that we know you're listening. Give us almost like, say, giving us a light show or give us a show of some kind. And he put the mic down, and I thought, I really didn't give it any thought. I just thought, oh, that's crazy. But it was, what, 5 minutes?
Yeah, about that. You probably, yeah. I mean, it wasn't long.
It was about 5 minutes.
Came out the van.
And, I mean, the sky lit up like you. It was like a 4th of July fireworks show. And so what really, I guess what struck me at that point was I thought, you know, I believe, you know, this is my own personal political belief. I think the United States has taken gas from so many countries. You know, we keep giving money away and they all act so arrogant and smug about it. And I mean, I know we're not saints, you know, and I'm sure that overseas we haven't behaved ourselves exactly as one would want to hope that we would, you know, so we've got our faults as well. But still in all, when you get right down to it, the good old USA has financed more people overseas and more countries and everything. And now we've got North Korea, you know, acting the way they are. And it hit me. I thought, you know, that fellow that runs North Korea, I wonder if he's ever given any thought as to what we've got technology wise here that even our people don't even have a clue as to what we've got in the bottle. And, you know, if it were necessary to unleash what I saw in the sky out there would be enough to scare me away. I wouldn't want to mess with the USA. I'd say, no.
Well, no. Yeah, and he reminds me of, you know, you can picture in your mind the little bully that the big guy's holding back his forehead with the heel of his hand while he sits there and swings at the air, you know, trying to reach him. And it's like, come on, man, don't, you know, you don't even want to go there. I mean, you got to have a death wish if you push it far enough. You know, and we may never even respond in that way, but the guy's delusional.
Well, you know, when I saw what I saw out there, though, I thought, wow, you know, yeah, this country's the last bunch of guys on earth. Our military, you better just not mess with them, you know, because I think we've got technology in the bottle, so to speak, that no one even suspects that we have, you know. And
I believe you're right. I'm doing.
You make a trip out there, you know. So now, you know, there's a strong parallel, though. I mean, we've got the folks running the little alien out there near Area 51. And they've got quite a bit of tourist trade, people coming in and out of the place. And so there's an interest in this. I mean, there really is an interest. And, of course, Roswell, I'm sure, is, you know, you have a lot of tourist trade there, people coming and curiosity seekers and whatnot. So this is cool. Well, so before we get too far off the track, though, I want you to once again kind of repeat the whole deal about the special event station that's going on in Roswell so everyone knows about it and everybody has a chance to work the station.
Absolutely. Well, we'd certainly welcome anybody to tune in. We'll be and give us a holler and try to make contact with us. We'll be on 14.245 megahertz. That's plus or minus 10. And we'll be on there from 9 to 5 Mountain Daylight Time. Now, I'm looking here right at my own website I put up here, so I do have the Zulu time on there. We're talking 1600 Zulu to 1259 Zulu. And that's July 1st through July 4th. And we'll be there operating from the UFO, International UFO Museum and Research Center in downtown Roswell. So we certainly would invite and appreciate anybody to come on frequency and give us a holler. And we're probably going to have a secondary station on 40 meters as well. We just don't know about the frequency there yet. And if you go to our website at PecosValleyARC.com, you can see a picture of the certificate that we'll be issuing. And we're asking for a $5 donation. And when you send your QSL card, the $5 donation to us at the address listed, we'll go ahead and get that certificate ready and get it back to you. We'll provide the envelope for returning the certificate and all that. That's what that $5 does, is covers the cost of all that goodies. But it's rather an impressive-looking certificate. I think anybody would really be proud to have that as part of their collection. But, yeah, we just look forward to making the contacts. We're excited to do it. And if you're in the Roswell area, come on through. Come all the way back. We'll have some signs up. All it's going to say is W5ZU with an arrow. So us hams know what that is. And just follow us all the way back to the back. Come say hello, and we'd just be glad to see you if you're out this way.
Well, tell us a little bit about your amateur radio group or club that you have there in terms of membership and activities.
Well, the Pecos Valley Amateur Radio Club is really a very old club. It's been around for decades, and although it's had its highs and lows, we're kind of coming back up on the upswing again. We've got a lot of new recent interest in the club and new members, and it's just, we're trying to get more and more involved doing different things. We do an occasional fox hunt. And then we do VE testing about once a quarter or so. We have one coming up July the 15th. And then we've also got, we monitor and monitor the local races that the city holds, in return for our overhead. And we enjoy doing that. And just different things we do. We hold classes for folks that are interested in their technician class, getting their technician class, and we do some classes that are kind of like ham cram classes centered around that. Let's see what else we do. We're always trying to come up with something, the hands on or some kind of a training class or something, and then every Saturday morning at 0900 local, we have a coffee meeting, or if we're not out running a race or something, we have our monthly business meeting on the first Saturday of every month at same place, 0900, same time. And if anybody's in the area, we're located at 403 North Richardson in Roswell. And again, all that information's on our website at PecosValleyARC.com. But we're just getting more and more interest. The special events will be a first for us. We try to get together on field days and do that kind of thing. So, we're just always got, well, it seems like we've always got something going on, and we just encourage and invite anybody that's in the area to come on in, contact us somehow, and say hello. We'd love to have you come on board and join the club and see what
we can do. I think this will be the start of something big for you, though, because I think that there's such an intense interest in Roswell. Everybody's going to want to get that certificate and or a QSL card or something. Put it on the wall that they've worked the special event station at Roswell, and we'll mention this two or three times in the show. And then what you'll have to do now, did you start operating today?
We went down and we kind of did an operational check, but we won't actually officially start our station until the first, which is Saturday.
Okay, all right. So then, what we need to do then Saturday night, Saturday evening, you guys need to, well, if there's a, if you, of course, you can't operate till after 5 o'clock. I said, say we get on at night,
right,
and talk about it and say what frequency you're on. But we can do that Friday evening when we're on. You can make sure you give us the frequencies and everything, and we'll announce them again on the air. And that way, folks that are listening, we've got a lot of guys listening. And, of course, they're going to research. They're going to go to your website, and they're going to find the information just as long as we talk about it and they're, aware of it. I was going to say, though, how long have you lived in the Roswell area?
Well, I've lived here off and on for probably 30 years or so. I first actually came through here with my stepdad back in the 60s. Walker Air Force Base was in operation then. And I came back here with him, and he was actually from, was raised in Kentucky, and he met my mom and I in California. And so as we kind of traveled around searching for the rainbow there, we found Roswell. We came through here back in the 60s and liked the place so much. And anyway, we wound up leaving and came back in the 70s where I went to high school for a couple of years. And then when it came time for me to kind of settle down and everything, I was living, I think, in Ohio at the time, northern Ohio. And I wanted to settle down somewhere, and I just kind of thought of all the places I lived. I mean, I'd lived in Chicago, Los Angeles, western Kentucky, and, of course, here in Roswell. I thought, well, I really kind of like Roswell. I felt it calling my name. So came back here and kind of settled down, and this is where I met my wife and the love of my life. We've been married for 37 years in September. And I tell her, when they ask me if I've ever seen an alien, I say, well, yeah, I married one. She's from here. So anyway, but... No, she was born and raised here in Roswell, so and we've moved away as a family since then, but always seem to come back. And it's really a quite livable area. I mean, it's got a dry heat. We're about 3,600 feet located in the Pecos River Valley. And it's just a really kind of a nice area to live.
You know, if somebody asks you if you've seen an alien, I think they'd be more apt to see something like that near Area 51. Because after all, Roswell was a crash. This was an unplanned landing.
Yeah. Sure. But by the same... Right, and by the same token, I mean, back in 1947, you know, we had the B-52 SAC base here with some of the longest runways in the country at the time for the B-52s, and there was a lot of stuff going on in this area. Of course, we have, you know, the White Sands Missile Range, we have the Los Alamos facility, so, I mean, there's really a lot of activity that goes on in this area, so it might have been a prime interest for any... extraterrestrials at the time, but like you said, by now today's standards, probably more of a focus there with Area 51. But yeah, it was generally definitely a hot spot around that time.
You know, I'll ask a couple questions and approach this from a little bit different standpoint. Everybody else tries to. They look at the military and they look at the picture of the balloon and they say, well, that was a cover up or whatever, you know. And there's a lot of different reasons given, but yet the story that Jesse Marcel told was a completely different story than what, and of course what they went and announced on the radio immediately after it happened, you know, is contradictory to what the military released or said. But here's the thing: people that's lived there all their lives, and people that's been in Roswell, obviously you've got to know quite a few of them, and I'm sure that they've become part of your life. What do you find there the general consensus is? I mean, how do the local people, this is their backyard, how do they view all of this? This, I think, would be a good barometer as to the reality of it.
Well, you know, once in a while it comes up in conversation, and to a lot of people it's just like, you know, well, yeah, there's a big reason around this time of the year to stay away from the downtown area is what a lot of them are. But to a lot of them, it's a means for, you know, tourist dollars coming in, and it boosts the economy of the area. But to actually talk and to see or get a consensus on what the general ideas of the validity of the reports and all, it's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, you know, me personally, I went to high school here in Roswell, and then again in elementary school back in the 60s. But during the 70s, I can remember going down to the local barbershop where I got my hair cut, and there was on the wall a framed copy of the headline, the front page of the Roswell Daily Record, where, you know, that was initially, you know, the famous picture of the headline of the RRAF, you know, of the UFO crash and this kind of a thing. So it's been known for a while, obviously, I mean, from 47, but it didn't really become a phenomenon until, 25, 30 years ago, I believe. But just to tell you a little story about me personally, when we left and moved to Denver back in 93, 94, I believe it was, I went to school there for a while. But I'm sitting there watching, and this is before this everything really became promoted and became a phenomenon. I'm sitting there watching TV one night there in Denver, and Unsolved Mysteries come on, the original one with, I forget his name, but you know what I'm talking about. And they're talking about the Roswell incident, and I'm looking, I said, what? And I'm starting to watch this thing, and one of the guys they're interviewing is William Woody, or I think we called him, I said James Woody goes by also, but that guy used to drive my school bus when I went to high school. I knew, you know, because I knew him, and it's like watching his course. I knew of some of the other people they were interviewing also, but I knew James Woody. He drove my school bus all the time, so it's like, this was really kind of cool to see this, but... I that might not have answered particularly the question you're trying to get, but yeah, it's interesting. And then Walter Haught, you know, was the public information officer at the Roswell Airfield, and I got to actually meet his mother. She was in a nursing home here in Roswell, and I was involved with Cub Scouts at the time and Tiger Cubs, and took our group up there one time to just go through and meet the different, you know, kind of just go up there and see the people and that kind of thing, you know, kind of an event there, public you know, activity for the Cub Scout group. And I got to meet Walter Hoth's mother, and she was still pretty sharp-minded even back then. And she was, you know, well up in her 90s at that time. So it's just interesting to go around and see and see these different, meet these different people that were, had either, for, you know, second-hand accounts of stories of what happened and such.
If you just went up, though, to the average person living in Roswell, let's say you took 10 people just at random, and you went to them and you said, you know, you've lived here. Say they've lived here all their lives and their parents lived there and all that. If you went up to them and said, what do you think happened? 10 random people that live there and who have lived there maybe going back two or three generations, what would be the general consensus in that department? I mean, how do you think they would answer you?
I think they would answer that at least something significant happened here. I think they would believe that. And I think a good part of them would believe it was something extraterrestrial. I really do.
Okay. So, in other words, and the reason I was saying that is because, you know, the Roswell story has been told. And, of course, there's books, there's videos. My goodness, if you go to YouTube and put in Roswell, I mean, your browser fills up with all sorts of videos about it. You know, there have been some very outspoken people like Stanton Friedman, who approaches it from a nuclear physicist standpoint. You know, but I mean, I think a good barometer, really and truly, would be the natives, the people who've lived there all their lives, and the stories that's been passed down, and you know, and of course the whole thing about a government cover up and all this kind of thing. And I think that to me, it seems as though the government probably did try to cover it up, you know, but the question is why? You know, why would they do that? And then I guess the next part of it is everybody knows that the government is real efficient in everything that they do.
Yeah, right.
So how do you think their cover-up's going to work? You know, I mean, it's just not... you know, just you know, it doesn't really hold water. And I think that's one of the reasons why it became so widespread. And I think there's also a phenomena involved. I think sometimes the more you try to cover up something, the more it escapes. You know, it's like catching a frog and putting him in the jar. You know, the harder you try to keep him in there, the more he tries to escape. So I don't know. And I thought the local constituents, and I think it's good that it's produced a lot of trade for the area. At least they're getting something out of that. But then, you know, it also raises the question, and that is there something significant itself, even today, about Roswell, you know, that links it to phenomena and other unknown things that, you know, that we explore and deal with? I've been talking about R&L Electronics for a good while, and you've heard me go on and on about Roger and the crew at R&L. When you call there, you get answers. They answer the phone. The people answering the phone are knowledgeable folks. They carry everything. They've got transceivers. They've got antennas. They've got microphones. They've got coax, linear amplifiers. They've got antenna tuners. I mean, they've got everything, ham radio. They're outfitted for the radio amateur. What a place to go. You'll love dealing with them because they're great people. You'll get great service. Everything will be shipped out promptly. There's nothing worse dealing with somebody that doesn't take your order seriously and you don't know whether or not it's going to get there on time. Believe me, I've been there. I've been there ordering ham gear. That does not happen with R&L Electronics. Roger and his folks care about you, and they care about the fraternity of ham radio. They want to keep you going. They want to keep it going. For the best price, the best possible price, and the best service and quality from individuals that know the amateur radio hobby and really care, remember the name R&L Electronics. Go up to the web, go to Google, and put in R&L Electronics. Contact them and go to their website, and you can't go wrong. One of the best kept secrets in ham radio is an online publication called The Spectrum Monitor. Have you ever heard of it? Well, if not, you need to go to their website. thespectrummonitor.com. That's thespectrummonitor.com. Each month, all kinds of pertinent articles pertaining to ham radio, shortwave, citizens band, scanning, Wi-Fi, you name it, it's in there. Color pictures, incredible writers writing these articles. You just have to check it out. You need to subscribe. Go to thespectrummonitor.com. Once again, the website is thespectrummonitor.com. Give it a look over and subscribe. thespectrummonitor.com. I want to tell you about something that's just absolutely, simply amazing. And you say, what's that? Well, it's the MFJ 939 automatic antenna tuner. And you ask, what's so amazing about it? Well, it's very small, compact unit. It'll handle up to 200 watts. I mean, it'll handle a Drake TR-4, a Swan 350, or any modern radio that's out there. You simply plug the output into the 939 antenna tuner, give it about 5 to 10 watts, and it just tunes. No cable. You don't have to have a cable running between the tuner and the radio. It's utterly fantastic, very quiet. You will love this thing, and it's priced unbelievably low. You need to go to the website, MFJEnterprises.com, and check out the 939 antenna tuner, or just Google MFJ 939. So anyways.
Well, it's just like my wife back in the day when they were running around as high school people. Today, she doesn't even really like to go out to Bottomless Lakes, which is a state park, you know, about 13 miles east of Roswell. While she was out there one night, they remember, and, you know, she doesn't drink, and but she remembers having an encounter, seeing a craft. I mean, that's just all she can describe it as. And, you know, it's just like everyone kind of looks at each other and says, how do you tell this? Who's going to believe you? You know, kind of a thing.
Oh, yeah.
But apparently, you know, apparently this thing came in and hovered above the ridge for, I don't know, couple of minutes, whatever it was, and then left. But yeah, I mean, you know, it happens a lot. And like I said, I mean, Roswell, it was historically reason to believe that this would be a real attraction for that kind of activity, and maybe even today. But you're not going to find a whole lot of people. To kind of further answer your question, Ted, you're not going to find a whole lot of people here who are just going to say, ah, that's just a bunch of hogwash. I mean, because most people, I think, would agree that to think that we are the only civilization in the universe is kind of, well, some say arrogant. I don't believe that. I just think with such a vast universe and a vast God, I mean, why would we necessarily be the only civilization out there? I don't know. It's just, you know,
well, the other thing
my
too,
mind's open. You know.
The other thing, too, is I think that it's really crazy because there's indications all throughout the Bible that would kind of point toward this kind of phenomena. I mean, you know, who knows what angels are? You know, do angels really have wings and fly, or is that what we were told, or is that how they were depicted? Because they did travel through the sky, you know, and they did have extraordinary powers, and they did did all kinds of things. I mean, so I think shutting it down from a religious standpoint is being extremely closed-minded, because I don't think it has anything to do. It provides no interference or no discredit to the story of the gospel and the story of Jesus Christ, which is not a story but a reality. I don't think it affects that in any way, shape, or form. I think what it is we're getting a glimpse. We're getting a glimpse of things that we don't know anything about. Things that are probably not paranormal or supernatural, but actually natural, you know, as the way I see it. So, and the fact that a craft would crash, who knows? I mean, that's you know, it's above my pay grade, but I'm just going to say I don't see all this conflict. And if the government's trying to cover it up because they're afraid that the public's going to panic, I think they're wrong. I think the public is way beyond that at this point. But anyhow.
Well, yeah. And it's just like the whole, I mean, the lifelong fight between religion and science. And that's a whole new different, I mean, that's a whole different subject, actually. But why does it have to be divided? Why can't it you know, more or less support one another, you know. And that's my take on it, is that one explains the other and vice versa. I mean, it's just, they support each other. But, you know, some folks don't see it that way, and that's, it takes all kinds, I suppose.
Well, I suppose, you know, the thing that that crosses my mind, David, you're just not saying anything. Are you part of the government?
I'm enjoying.
Are you part of the government cover-up and all that kind of stuff?
No, there's nothing to talk about here.
Nothing to talk about here. We have nothing to discuss.
Move along.
What if, and I'll say this because if there's been other significant sightings there, and of course you would know that from talking to local people to some degree, because I think for the most degree, if the average person went outside to take the trash out and they happen to look up in the sky and they see this object that is obviously not anything of this world, and they go back inside, you know, they're probably going to go over to the refrigerator and grab a beer, open it, sit down, turn on the television set, shake their head, and the wife will say, "What's wrong?" And they're going to go, "Oh, nothing."
Yeah, you wouldn't believe it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of think we're to that point, you know. Because yeah. I notice objects in the sky all the time. I have no idea what they are. And, I mean, they could be. Some of them could be aircraft, but I'm sure some of them are not. But nobody asks a question. It's like, what is it, the three monkeys? I see no evil, hear no evil, speak no, you know, whatever. You know. But I guess the thing I'm looking at is I'm wondering, is there something about the Roswell area that draws that kind of thing in? It's almost like, you know, is there an oil well there, something of value, or has there been some sort of a center established somewhere, central point of some kind, you know? So, you know, and that attracts, and that's the reason why for, you know, something like the Roswell crash was because they were doing business there, you know, some kind, you know.
Sure.
So you wonder that.
And it's open to all kind of speculation, and you could go there. I mean, geographically, where the southeast part of the state's a little different than the other two, three-thirds, or three-quarters, you know, it's a little more plains and that kind of thing. And then, like I said, you've had the other operations going on, and they're not even really going on in this part of the state, and that being Los Alamos and White Sands and such. But, you know, who knows? I mean, like I said, there's so much above our pay grade that we just don't know. So, you know, we have the missile silos scattered all about the countryside, and, you know, it just, who knows what's going on in any of them, you know? So
do you know of any actual active missile silos near where you're at?
I don't know of any active ones. I know several people who have bought the abandoned ones, and some of them have done stuff with them, and others have just parked mobile homes on them and haven't really done anything with them. But yeah, there's people that, you know, just purchased the property, and I don't know if they have any kind of contractual limitations to what they can or can't do in terms of those silos. You know, they might have, I think the Air Force still has some kind of a stipulation with the housing out here at what we call the base, which used to be Walker Air Force Base, where, you know, in a time of need, they could come in and take it back over again. But, you know, I don't know if there's anything like that or not, but I don't know of any active missile silos, to be honest with you.
Well, the one fellow that supposedly worked at Area 51, the Bob Lazar, supposedly he had bought one of those silos, him and a partner, and they had turned it into a residence, you know. And I had heard that. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I had heard.
And yeah, I've heard of people doing that.
So that's I wonder how expensive it would be to purchase a silo and then turn it into a shortwave radio station, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I've actually, at my residence, I have a bomb shelter, which is kind of interesting. My house was built back in the early 50s, and there were several houses in our neighborhood that if you could afford them, you'd have a bomb shelter put in. And it's rather interesting. It's kind of a corrugated half pipe buried, and it's pretty good length. It's about 20 feet long by, say, about 10 feet wide, 10 or 15 feet wide. And it's got a... it's got two riser pipes, one at each end, and with a hand crank on one end, and you can actually that's how you, you know, get your air exchange going, is you crank that crank and you can manually get you some air exchange going in there. And it's even got hot and cold running water and electricity in it.
Yes. Of course, yeah, I would expect during a... Go ahead, David.
$275,000, you can have yourself a missile silo.
A missile silo is $275,000?
Yeah, this is... I was just looking online here. There's an Atlas F missile site for sale. So that's going for the low, low price of only $275,000.
I was going to say, at that price, let's just get two of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be a novel thing to do, would be to have a missile silo turned into a residential property. I guess you'd feel pretty secure there, I guess, if anything else.
Well, yeah, and then I hear that, you know, it's even like in my bomb shelter, it's during the wet season, it tends to get a little damp and moist down there, and I don't know how that would work as a residence for a missile silo. I mean, it seems like you'd have to do some pretty good sealing, but I don't know if, you know, that was just my thought. I don't, because I have heard some of them kind of get a water table down there, so I mean, they're pretty deep. They're several hundred feet deep, aren't they?
I would think so.
I wouldn't know.
I don't either. But you know, one would think that it would need to be withstand.
Of course, you have an indoor built-in swimming pool if you know kind of built your living area on the different mezzanines and levels around there.
Well, you know what? I think one thing you really ought to do is while you're doing your special event station, and maybe even as an activity, maybe get a good size Yagi and an amplifier and get up on one of the VHF frequencies and point that thing straight up in the sky and just call CQ, you know, because if they're out there and they are intelligent, they're going to know what CQ is. And if you promise to send them a QSL card, who knows, you know. Now, I've always been very, very curious about that. I've often thought, you know, would radio be the means of contact? Would they use radio? Would radio be it? Or is there some other form of, some other form of communication that they would use that involves technology of some kind? I don't know. That's just a lot.
I don't know. And the only thing that discourages me about that is SETI's been doing this for decades, and I don't know if they've got. Of course, I don't know what frequency they're tuned. I would think they have a rather wide range of frequencies they're listening, but I don't think they've ever heard anything to speak of, have they?
They've had a couple of. I'm fairly certain they've had a couple of things that they've received.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm very, very skeptical of that whole thing, because I think that even if they did get a signal, would anyone let them talk about it?
Right. Right. Yeah, it could be just like this other deal. I mean, they aren't just going to come out and do a press release on it. Oh, well, we heard, signals from whatever Centauri next galaxy or whatever it is, you know. I don't said hello. No, but, and another thing, too, now this is kind of that possibility thinking, or, you know, kind of open your mind up. But this is what I've always wondered, you know, and I'm sure you guys have seen the movie Frequency with Jim Caviezel, where he talks to his dad, you know, 20 years ago by the ham radio when the Aurora Borealis is running. I'm sure you've both seen that movie, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's fictitious and it's kind of far out there. But now stop and think about this. I mean, we're sending signals out there constantly every day at 186,000 miles per second. I mean, and we've got this vastness of the universe. And who's to say at some point out there, we might not get a return of a signal that we sent out 20 years ago. I mean, it's one of those possibility thinking things that has always intrigued me. And I thought, wow, wouldn't that be cool? I mean, it just kind of blows your mind to think about that. I think.
Yeah. And I don't know. Also, I think that, from listening to the people talk about the SETI operation, I think they enter into it, with a certain amount of skepticism, I guess I want to say. I mean, I don't see true anticipation there. It's like almost like let's throw it out there and you know, any signal that comes back that could have possibilities, you know, let's see how far we can discount it, you know. And yeah. and I also think if they, you know, if they actually tuned in and caught a interterrestrial top 40 countdown, extraterrestrial top 40 countdown, there'd be somebody swooping in, the men in black and the men in green and the men in every color, and telling them, you know, shut up, or the people that received the signal would just disappear. You know, there's been, you think about the people that have disappeared, you know, in bizarre situations like that, you know. So I don't know. I think all of it has a lot of control. I kind of see the SETI thing as a almost a counterintelligence measure. You know, well, we've been doing this for 50 years and we haven't heard a darn thing. You know, wow, what a cover that is. You know, if it is, but you know, and for the folks that work really hard trying to do SETI, the volunteer SETI. Mm-hmm. There's another one that they use your computer or something and crunch numbers and all that kind of stuff. The people that are doing that, God bless them. And I don't mean to insult, but you know, if you're trying to cover something up, then what a perfect cover that would be.
Well, it'd be nice if you could go on the internet and tune in, listen to their frequencies they're receiving. I probably couldn't do that though. Maybe they have a couple or three on there that are publicly accessible, just to kind of, I don't know. I've never looked into it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but there's been stories. There's been stories of people who have had receivers on and have gotten really strange, very, very strange, you know, radio signals, and they would be in their home and the signal would respond to thoughts they were having. You know, I mean, I've read several articles about that kind of thing. They'd be thinking something and then all of a sudden the signal on the air would respond, you know. So I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, but I'm not quick to write it off. Now, let me change tracks here just a little bit and ask you this question, and that is, what was your beginnings? How did you even learn about amateur radio? How did you get it started in this?
Well, you know, I can remember back in the day growing up, I was telling you earlier about my stepdad that met my mom, married her, and we moved from Southern California back toward the East. Well, I can remember living in Western Kentucky. Probably my first experience with two-way radio, of course, was on 11 meters. And my dad lived in Chicago at the time, and then he worked up there, and then he would come home on the weekends down to Western Kentucky, and we lived right on the Ohio River, right outside of Owensboro. So he set me up with a little base station there, a little tube-type Lafayette with on a trick stick. And he would come down on the weekends, and just for fun, we would start getting relays. Like, he'd be up around Terre Haute or Vincennes, and we'd start setting up relays. Some of the guys there in Evansville would set up relays for us, and we'd talk back and forth, and he'd get in range. You know, as a child, that was cool stuff. I looked forward to that. And from that time forward, you know, he'd come home down there in his 62 Chevy convertible with a big tube-type Johnson under the dash or something like that. And I just fell in love with radio. And then as time went on, of course, I always had a CB in the car anywhere I went or with me. And then when I moved to Denver, like I told you, in 1993 or 94, I believe it was, met a blind guy up there. He turned out being one of my best friends, and he was in broadcast radio for Crawford Broadcasting up there. And he not only encouraged me to get my ham radio ticket, but he also got me into broadcast radio, which I did for years part-time. But anyway, we got my ticket, hence the call KB0 QNW there in Denver. And from there, it just kind of... Actually, and to be honest with you, I'm still to this day mostly a VHF, UHF guy. Some digital EMS over VHF and UHF, but I've just always had a love for two-way radio. And since I've had a ticket, now I've had my ham ticket since it's about 95 around there somewhere. And that's kind of been my humble beginnings, and kind of humble even now. I mean, like I say, I don't do a whole lot of HF, but I'm really enjoying what we're doing now with the special events and field day and things of that nature. And maybe one of these days I'll get a station up here at the QTH. But that's really kind of been my experience. Nothing really earth shattering, you know, but it's been fun. I enjoy meeting people, enjoy just enjoy the hobby.
Well, if you had to pick one single point that was a catalyst in all of that that you're talking about, what would be the strongest point that you think drove you to go ahead and get a license and get on the air?
I would say it was my friend Bob Fetty, again, who was there with Crawford Broadcasting in Denver, and he was real instrumental in getting me involved. And I think he was kind of the real catalyst. Yeah, Bob was had such a good radio voice and was so into it, and got me involved in the broadcast end of it. Helped me get my first job there with Crawford, and I would have to say him. Yeah,
the very very first radio job I ever had was age 15, and I'd called the radio station and said, you know, like a lunatic, a kid's going to call a radio station and ask for a job, you know. And right. The fellow on the other end of the phone said, well, come on down here and talk to me. So I went, had my mom drive me to the station, and he hired me. And that was a Crawford radio station. That was WMUZ in Detroit. And the fellow, I was going to say that today that's the chief engineer there is Brian Kirkin, but the fellow that hired me was Chuck Cawson Jr., and his dad was kind of like the manager of the station, or was the manager of the station. And Chuck was kind of like the overall operations guy. But, you know, I wrote him a note the other day, and I said, you know, I was hired in at WMUZ, and I was just a kid at 15, and I was running the board. And I said, here I am now, the age that I am, and I'm still running the board. You know, well, you told me there was room for advancement in this business, you know.
Right.
But that was so unusual for them to, for someone like that to hire, you know, a kid that age without a driver's license. And, of course, then I got the driver's license, then I could be late to work on my own. But
right.
That was an excellent experience or training ground for somebody who was just starting out. Crawford was a let me ask you this: when did you depart? Say, working in radio. When did you decide that you were going to do something different?
Well, actually, here's the deal: I've never worked radio, broadcast radio, full time. It's always been my fun job. And so when I worked for Crawford, well, for a while there, when I was living in Denver, I went to work, after I got my A&P certificate and came out of, Colorado Aerotech and got my A&P certificate. I realized that there was a lot less liability working on baggage systems than there were aircraft. So I went to work at, Denver International Airport working on their baggage system, the famed, boondoggle that, you know, never really wound up working right. But I worked on that system for about 6 years. And always did, that was my breadwinner, and always did radio part-time. So I hired on with Crawford, working their four stations there in Denver. It was, you know, KLZ, KLTT, and there were a couple of others. But did some board hopping and different things before everything became so automated, a little bit of on-air announcing, that kind of thing. And then my really cool, fun job in radio was going on with Jones Radio. They're based there out of Littleton, I think. And I'd drive 32 miles across the metro there. I lived up on the north side. I'd drive across there twice a weekend for, you know, a 5-hour gig on the overnights on Jones Radio. That's feeding to 90-plus stations live across the country. And that was a fun job. But I did that and then moved back to... took a job transfer back to Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky International Airport, worked on their baggage system for a while, and again, got another part-time job at Froggy in Vivi, Indiana. And that's another, there's a real cool story, you know, if you have time. I don't know what you're looking for time here, but that's another cool story.
Well, tell your cool story. Now you got me interested here. Man. We'll have to cancel. We'll cancel the next program in order to get this in. Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate it. But no, this was before working for Jones. So we went back to Warsaw, Kentucky, and right across the river was Vivi, Indiana. And they had a little station over there, a little FM-er, and they needed a part-time board op to run the board during sports, during basketball season and stuff. So I said, okay, cool. So I did that, and I would go in and out of spots and everything during the games and all that. So after the season... a new manager had come in, and he was upgrading the equipment and everything, getting ready to get the satellite feed from Jones. So at this time, at that time, I didn't know Jones from anybody. So anyway, my wife didn't particularly, she just didn't like living back there. She just never did adapt to the culture of the humidity and all that kind of stuff because she was from Roswell. So she finally talked me into putting in for a transfer back to Denver. And we said, well, we'll go back to Denver. And so we did that. And but before all that happened, I asked the fella, the manager, after ball season was over, I said, do you need me to go ahead and stay on? I said, I can, you know, do voice stuff and just whatever. And he says, no, I don't really think we need you anymore. And I said, okay, fine. So I went ahead and left, and a month or two later, whatever it was, I wound up moving back to Denver. But when I went back to Denver, Jack Rowland was the chief engineer there at Crawford, and he had left Crawford and went to work for Jones. So he was also a ham. So I was talking to him one time, and he said, hey, why don't you come on down to Jones? I'll put in a good word for you and try to get you on as host down here. So I said, okay, cool. So I got on the CD Country format, working Friday and Saturday night overnights there at Jones. So when I got on, you know, you go in and you know how you line her up. You make all your 3 or 4 second liners specific to each of the affiliates' radio station IDs. And then when you hit the auto fire button or the station auto fires at the top of the hour, it sends your voice from each individual affiliate across the country identifying their station. And then you come in right afterwards. Of course, during that 3 or 4 seconds, you're just looking at your VU meters laying over on the side because there's no audio going out from your board. But anyway, point is, before you do that, when you go in and hire on, you've got to line her up for all these different affiliates across the country. Well, one of them happened to be Froggy in VV, Indiana. So I called up the secretary there one time and said, hey, guess what? I'm back. So they decided to let me go and not keep me on, but I wound up being back on their station anyway on BB in BB, Indiana through the satellite. And it was just, you know, something like that. I don't know how often that would happen in life, but it was kind of cool the way it all worked out.
What was the, was it a country format?
Yeah, CD Country was more or less a, I can't remember the demographics, but it was, you know, fairly modern country, you know.
That's interesting because, you know, the country has gone through these cycles of being a very popular radio format, and then one that where the popularity has waned, and then I don't even know where it places now, as far as radio broadcast is concerned, because most of the country I hear on the stations here in Nashville that are the larger FM stations, I personally couldn't call it country. I don't know. I guess I would have to say it's. Yeah. It's a pseudo form of rock and roll, at least what it is. At least sounds like that to me.
Folks, I want to talk to you for just a minute about the Main Trading Company. The proprietor, Richard Lenore, a ham radio guy through and through. His whole life is ham radio. He's the guy that started the Ham Fest in Paris, Texas. And now, of course, he's the proprietor of... If you go up to the website, you're going to see amateur radio. You're going to see new open box demos. You're going to see connectors and adapters. And you're going to see educational toys and FRS, GMRS. You're going to see radio accessories. You're going to see package deals. I mean, it's all up here. It's too numerous to mention. He's got radios. Of course, he carries Elenco, Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu, MFJ. He's got all of Martin Jew's products over there at the MFJ. You can order anything you want to. The best prices. There is just no way you can beat them. The Main Trading Company, especially if you're west of the Mississippi near Paris, Texas, you need to buy from Richard Lenore, KA5DX, the Main Trading Company. And it says here, free U.S. shipping on most orders over $100. You know, go up to their website, the Main Trading Company. Go up there and just Google them. If you can't find the website, Google them. Once again, they're in Paris, Texas.
But they've got everything you could possibly want. And just to name a few things, they've got wires and cables and antennas and amplifiers and antenna tuners and radios and handhelds and VHF, UHF, the whole deal. And if you're confused and you've got questions, pick up the phone and call and talk to Richard Lenore. You can't go wrong. These are people that you'll love to deal with. You'll make friends for life. The Main Trading Company in Paris, Texas. That's where you need to go. There are few geniuses in the world today, but one of them is Bob Greenberg, W2CYK. He invented R-Finder. What this is an app for your cell phone. And, of course, your cell phone knows where you are by means of GPS. When you go into a city or even your hometown and open up R-Finder, it tells you every repeater in your immediate area. It gives you the split. It gives you the PL tone. It tells you whether it's on Echolink, IRLP, or DMR. All of it's there, all the information you need on R-Finder. Go to rfinder.net. That's rfinder.net. If you've got a two-way radio in your car, you're a ham operator and a cell phone, you need rfinder. rfinder.net. The best tasting coffee in the entire world comes from a blind coffee roaster who's been blind from birth, Jerry Leary. His company is The Unseen Bean. Go to his website, theunseenbean.com. You'll be glad you did. Try his kilowatt blend or his contester's blend. Theunseenbean.com. But
well, that's it. And I just totally don't have any interest in watching the award shows anymore. I mean, that's just me, and that's a lot of us old timers that like country music, and we've seen and heard the way it's gone, and it's like, you know, they've adapted to the younger crowd and to that more of a pop culture to get the the fan base back up or to maintain the fan base. But a lot of us just don't have any real interest in it anymore, and we tend to do more of the traditional stuff.
Now, you worked at the Denver airport then?
Yes.
All right. Now, there has been, and I spent some time there on a plane flight, and I was looking, there was an article published, and this fellow said that there was a door that led to an underground labyrinth of hallways and tunnels and all kinds of things, you know, and he described where this door was, and we went to look for it, and sure enough, we found the door that he was talking about. I found a door that fit the description, but of course, we couldn't get in because it was a locked door. You know,
well, how did you even get out to the door? That's what I'm trying to.
No, it's in a main corridor. It's in a main corridor in the. In the airport, supposedly that door, if you unlock it and go in it, it's supposed to take you downstairs and into this labyrinth of rooms and tunnels and all kinds. Well, what I was going to ask you about is this has been a big rumor. I mean, everybody has heard this thing about there's something going on underneath the Denver airport. So I was just wondering, right, working there, had you ever picked up on anything like that, or have you ever heard of that at all?
Quite honestly, the time that I worked there, I never heard that. Now, it's quite easy for me to believe, or it could happen, because even in the tunnels that I had access to in the baggage maintenance area, see, most of the baggage system is one floor underneath ground level, and I had access to all that underneath the main tunnels, underneath the main where the train, the shuttle train ran out to different concourses, under the terminal itself and under the concourses. I mean, it's just a massive amount of passageway under there. Now, as you go all the way to the north end of the airport, out past Concourse C, the airport was built expandable, where past Concourse C, they could put a Concourse D, E, so forth to the north. So as you come out to the north end, you go up a ramp, which takes you out onto the ramp, out on the tarmac. Now, was there another door around to the side of that or more exit. I mean, there's a thousand possibilities where that could happen. So, yeah. And, you know, one of the things was the whole thing is that whole area is built on bentonite. So there was always a lot of mudjacking going on and things that, you know, trying to keep the airport from basically sinking, because I witnessed that firsthand where the pilings and the supports would sink down below the floor level 2 or 3 inches. I mean, it's just, you know, but that's quite possible. And it's like I said, it's strange. I never really heard about that till after I left.
Yeah, just, yeah, you go up and Google it, put, you know, up, just Google it, go up to YouTube, and there's, I mean, it's unreal. Uh-huh. Of course, you know, there's the whole story about the tunnels that are underneath the Walmart stores and fences up around the Walmarts, and they're going to turn them into concentration camps, and underneath the Denver airport, that's going to be a concentration camp. And you you wonder if none of this stuff is true. What kind of mind dreams it up? You know, who is it that comes up with this stuff?
Well, sure. I mean, and stranger than fiction is just what's underneath the White House. That's interesting stuff.
And you know,
there's documentaries out there on that.
I've never heard about that. So that's a whole new set. What's supposed to be under the White House? I would imagine they have it. I would imagine they'd have a bunker under there for all kinds of
They have all kinds of stuff. Yeah, I mean there's just facilities under there that are completely self-contained that are designed to, you know, sustain the cabinet and, you know, the president and his cabinet and the high folks that are worth saving, I guess, or protecting, but can protect them under there and sustain them for, I guess, years. I don't know. But, yeah, History Channel or somebody like that, Discover, or somebody's got documentaries, if you go on YouTube again and look. But it's interesting stuff. A lot of it has been, I mean, they've allowed the crews to go in and tape. Now, obviously, there's probably areas where they can't. But like that, and what's Colorado Springs, the mountain under there? That's another interesting place, too.
And you hear these things. It's like Wayne Green, who the fellow that, I don't know if you know who Wayne Green is or was, that had 73 Magazine and started a ton of magazines, you know. But Wayne maintained that we never went to the moon, that was all staged out in Hollywood somewhere. So,
What is it? Oh, well, just like another full, just like the Billy the Kid thing. I mean, there's another whole story out there of what happened to Billy the Kid. He never got shot and killed in Fort Sumner by Sheriff Garrett. I mean, there's, you know, there's always somebody that's got a different story that, oh, yeah, you didn't hear the real story. This is the real story, blah, blah, blah. So,
well, yeah. It's the same thing. We've got a fellow that's writing a bunch of articles and there's all kinds of stuff on YouTube by a fellow by the name of Michael Skutnik, who has pictures and all kinds of things, and says that Elvis faked his death and he's still alive, and he's preaching at a church in Benton, Arkansas, under the name of Bob Joyce. Yeah, you read it, you look at it, and you know, I'll tell you, it's difficult when you hear all the story. It's very difficult to scratch your head and say, well, you know what? I believe this. Or, you know what? This is bunk. I mean, it catches you right in the middle, you know, so you don't really know. I'm going to make a trip to Benton, Arkansas, and I want to go out there on a Sunday morning and go to this guy's church and and listen.
Well, they just auctioned off his aircraft. You know, it was sitting out here in the boneyard at Roswell Industrial Air Center. Been sitting out there for eons, and I guess they just auctioned it off. From what I understand, I saw it on the news the other day.
Yeah, I saw it. They had pictures inside and all that. Now, let's get back to our. You know, we go down all these rabbit holes on QSO Live. There isn't anywhere we won't go, I guess, except just a few areas. but anyhow. Your beginnings into ham radio, I think, is a real interesting story, especially as closely tied as you were to broadcast radio. And I think there is definitely a link between ham radio and broadcast radio. And I think the best radio engineers I've ever met in my life were all hams. You know, they really were, because they, you know, that was their way of living the RF environment. I mean, they lived for antennas and for, oh, I mean, what do you think, David? You're sitting here silent. I mean,
actually, I'm still kind of intrigued over the missile silo stuff. I'm thinking about how to design an antenna out of that sucker, and you know what all we could do with that.
I guess what I was going to say is that I think the idea right now of you doing a special event station from Roswell, New Mexico, is really quite a attraction. To the fraternity of ham radio, because I guess that's an exciting special event station to work, and it also I think really captures the intent of what a special event station is supposed to be, you know, and it doesn't always have to be like at a famous location. A special event station can be commemorating anything, you know, but
sure,
you know, but something like Roswell is you'll have a, you know, international interest in this. People from all over will be wanting to hear it and work it and whatnot. But I'm kind of curious as to how you guys came up with this idea.
Well, I'll tell you, I was just going to kind of go in that direction. Our club president, I'm vice president, our club president, Gary Blosser, NM5GB, is quite a bit more involved in HF than I am. But we're also in touch, of course, occasionally with our, and he's going to be the state emergency manager for Aries. Anyway, Jay Miller, and I can't believe can't remember his call right offhand, but at the prompting of Jay to Gary, Jay started kind of prodding Gary on this idea, saying, hey, you know, here's what you do here and here's what you do there. Well, anyway, I guess some other people got a hold of that as well and started kind of feeding Gary with these different ideas and what have you. And before we knew it, Gary's kind of like all on fire about this. And me, I told you, I'm not a real HF guy. I'm more VHF, UHF. So, but, you know, I thought, well, okay, I'll jump on the wagon with this and see what we can do and get, you know, get excited about it and all that. And yeah, that's kind of where it sprung off of. But like you said, it just seems to kind of be a natural hand-in-hand thing somehow or other with the phenomenon of the Roswell incident and with ham radio. It just seems to kind of be a shoe-in, a natural. But that's how it kind of all got started. And so we're just kind of going with it. And like I say, I mean, we've had a lot of training exercises and a lot of opportunities, like field day. We used a field day to try out some logging software and see how that was going to work for us and to get some people who really haven't had a whole lot of experience on HF, because HF's a whole different world from VHF, UHF. And so we got some people with some hands-on experience in that area. And so we just hope we can, and we feel like we can, but kind of live up to the, you know, ready to meet up to the challenge and to do it justice, because I think we are going to get a huge response if the conditions are good at all, because of the whole Roswell incident phenomenon, you know, so many people are really interested in that, and really intrigued by it.
Well, let me ask you this. Will you be doing any, you mentioned the one frequency on 20 meters, but are you folks planning on doing any CW work?
At this point in time, no. I just no. Nobody's mentioned anything about CW, and none of us. Let me think a minute. There may be one or two people that are regular active members of the club that know CW, but I don't think any of us really do.
Well, that might be the key to some extraterrestrial contact is through CW.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, I've said this a long time. I really admire Hiram Percy Maxim, the original W1AW guy. I mean, this guy had imagination that wouldn't quit. I mean, and to come up with things like the Wolf Hong and the Ready Snitch and the description as to how they're supposed to be used and all that. And then there's a little award of some sort. I don't know what it looks like, but it's at the league headquarters for the first radio amateur that contacts Mars. You know, and they get that award. Well, back during Hiram's day, that was just unthinkable. I mean, he was really reaching on that thing. But still, you know, real active imagination. But today, it's not that far away.
No, some of these guys were just ahead of their time. That's all.
But he would write all these articles, you know, under the name The Old Man, you know, and nobody knew who it was. He remained anonymous, and then he would blast all the bad practices of ham radio. But, you know, you look at this, you look at him and the imagination that he had, having saying that the first you know, contact with Mars gets this award. So, you know, I think that's... I think that's kind of cool, and doing a Roswell special event station, I think, kind of goes hand in hand with his type of imagination. Or at least that's.
They should have put a beacon on one of those Mars crafts we sent up there. Should put a beacon on it or something, where we could, you know,
tune in and listen to.
Yeah.
But in light of that, I've also said I think if there is going to be a contact with E.T., I don't think it's going to be SETI. I think it's going to be a ham.
Yeah.
I believe it will be a radio amateur, you know, because I just think that, you know, intelligence is attracted to intelligence. And I think that, you know, the SETI thing is just a, you know, you'd sit there listening for what? You know, what would be their reason to transmit, you know, if they use radio at all, you know?
Sure, you might have a bunch of guys, or, you know, I'm sure they don't have a bunch of guys sitting around listening, but they probably go in and check, I don't know, their spectrum analyzers, or I'm just kind of, I know absolutely nothing about what I'm talking about, but like you said, they just probably walk in there and check it and have no real vested interest in, you know, really pursuing what they're listening to or what may be coming through and trying to decipher it, and I don't know, it's just.
Well, when you say you don't, you have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, have you ever considered running for office?
Yeah, I'd make a good politician, right?
There you go. No, I think it's phenomenal what they're doing. Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't discount that, but I still say that if there will ever be an extraterrestrial contact, I believe it will be done by an amateur radio operator, and I think that. It's a mindset. It's a certain degree of intelligence required, you know, and all of that. And I think that's how it would happen. But, you know, what do I know?
We have a huge, and I'll just say this: we have a huge amount of talent and expertise in the amateur radio field.
Oh my goodness! Yes,
you know, everywhere from. The guy just coming in that doesn't know a thing to the guy that has made, you know, communications and such his career and just has degrees and, you know, and just does this stuff for fun. I mean, it's just there's such talent. It's just an enormous amount of talent.
Well, we've all seen this in the radio engineering arena. Mm-hmm. Fellas graduate from school and they take the full curriculum and they graduate with engineering degrees. Okay. But then there's those guys that come up through the ranks of ham radio. People like Bob Heil is a good example. And they're geniuses. I mean, they are, I guess, they're the MacGyvers of technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was reading an article. It was very interesting. As a book, matter of fact, if folks have a chance to pick this up somewhere, the book is called Think Like Einstein, or How to Think Like Einstein. And one of the main points of the book was that Einstein basically colored outside the lines. You know, he didn't go by the rules, got in a lot of trouble, and yet look what he was able to accomplish. I think conventional thinking, you know, it's like in the book they talk about a person taking a train ride or a train trip from point A to point B. But to get where you want to go, you got to get off the tracks and travel through the woods, you know. And I think that's really true. I think it would really be true with extraterrestrial happen. I really don't. I think the person's going to have to leave the main train track and go down a pathway, a dirt road, or out in the middle of a field where no one's gone. And that's where you're going to have success.
Yeah, and the poor guy will be poo-pooed as, you know, whatever, a lunatic. And then, you know, another decade or two later, it'll hit mainstream and somebody else will take the credit. And it's like, well, dude, this guy did this 20 years ago and everybody thought he was a lunatic back then. You know, I mean, that's seems to be the way it happens. But.
Well, with ham radio, I mean, look, I mean, this is where our cell phone technology came from. And so many things that were developed under amateur radio conditions or by hams that we today use on a daily basis and really just don't think anything of it. I mean, that's just the way it is. And I think it's kind of cool, too, because even in your area, you obviously have emergency exercises and things. And talk about that a bit. Yeah, what kind of emergency stuff that you guys prepare for? What kind of, do you have drills or anything that gets people on their toes and ready to roll in case something bad was to happen? We've got some news for you folks that live in antenna restricted areas. You know what I'm talking about. And if it's not an HOA, it's a bunch of nosy neighbors. Well, listen, we've got some news for you. It's a new antenna. It's called the Cobweb. That's right, the Cobweb. And this thing is made by MFJ. It's incredible because it's 10 through 20 meters in all the bands in between. And it goes up real easy, and guess what? It disappears. It's got a very low takeoff angle. It's an excellent antenna. You have all kinds of fun with this thing. It's called the Cobweb. Go to the MFJ website. Just Google MFJ and Google MFJ Cobweb. Go up and take a look at this. You won't believe what you see, and you know once you see it, you're going to have one. It's the Cobweb from MFJ. The ICOM 7300. And now this is a contester's dream. It's a high-performance HF transceiver with a compact design. It doesn't miss a weak signal under any circumstances. And it's got the waterfall function and the real-time spectrum scope. Man, it's exactly what you need if you're a contester. ICOM has the reputation of being incredible in the performance and also the service they provide to you. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/amateur. That's ICOMAmerica.com/amateur.
Well, we do. And quite honestly and admittedly, we don't do as much of that as we used to. Alfred Lindsay was part of our group years ago, W5ALL, and moved away down to the southwestern part of the state. But he was really the one that spearheaded those exercises and all. And I've kind of tried to, a few of us have kind of tried to get back in the role of that. And we've done some Skywarn exercises. Of course, we've got a pretty active Skywarn group here. But different things we're trying to get more involved in, such as maintaining frequencies and doing a periodic operational checks of our equipment in our fire department's mobile command unit. And we're now trying to get some coax ran and some antenna or two installed on our EOC's tower, and trying to work more in that area of being prepared in the event that we need some of this things to help us out in the event of an emergency. But we do participate in some of the statewide events. We just had one back about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And it actually mocked a scenario that happened about 7 years ago in the state where a major fiber optic cable got severed. And the result was it basically severed the two halves of the state communication-wise. So, you know, we did a scenario that that played with that and played along those lines. And so we do things like that occasionally on a local basis as well. And so that's kind of more what I tend to focus on is the emergency preparedness part of it. A lot of us have go boxes, and we try to emphasize with each other to maintain those go boxes with different equipment and things of that nature. And you know, every time we go out, and one of the hams said this one time, and it's like it's always stuck with me and made so much sense. He says every time you get on that radio and start playing, he says you're really doing an emergency exercise because you know you're trying to see what frequencies you can hit, what repeaters you can hit from where, with what equipment, with this antenna, that antenna. And I'll tell you what, SHTF, so to speak, I mean, hams know what to do. Hams can get it done because communications is not just a sideline of what we do. It's not just a tool to do what we our other main thing. I mean, that is our thing, is communications, and we know what works and what doesn't. And I'll tell you what, when it does happen, we have had a couple little incidences. A few years ago, we had the Little Bear fire up in the southern Sacramento Mountains, and we were called upon to go up there and help out and set up some temporary stations and to augment their communications. And the American Red Cross, you know, they had a relief center set up and what have you. And we went out and deployed, and we had one of the guys in the bunch that's got a business with doing IT and set up, was able to be available to set up a mesh network, you know, the way they do that. I'm not sure with exactly, but we just had the resources there available. A lot of them were deployed. We got the job done, and we were ready to go and had a network set up between the medical centers and the relief areas for Red Cross and the local radio station who was handling the public broadcast, you know, pertaining to all that and such. So hams know what to do. We can get it done. We know where we can go and where we can't, and we're going to make it happen one way or the other.
Well, don't you think, though, in all of that you were doing, emergency exercises and even jumping in during actual emergencies, isn't that fun?
Oh, it is. It's a thrill. It really is. It's there's a little bit of adrenaline involved, which, you know, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I gave that up decades ago. But it is fun. It's neat to be able to have your equipment in place and know that at a moment's notice you can take it, go set it up, and the more you do it and the more you play with it and the more you go through the whole routine, then when it comes time to need it, it's just like second nature. It's just like breathing. Just go out and do it. That's one of the things too is we've been playing with. It's like my thing has been NBEMS, which we're taking you know, digital communications and MT63 format and mode, digital mode, and you can, you know, a lot of guys are using the signal links and the different interfaces between their computers and the radios. But the whole idea, and it's on ARRL's website, but this one ham wrote up this whole thing about MBEMS. And in a tight, you go out, and all you need is a computer and a radio. And either simplex or through the repeaters, you can do with FRS radios or whatever. You get your messages set up either in simple text form or through a format, you know, either through the ICS 213 forms or the ARRL message grams, message forms and stuff. And you can hold your mic right up to the speaker on the computer, hit the button, and it's going to spit the information in those digital garbled sounds, but it's going to go over the air, and you got another computer sitting there with next to a radio, and you're going to receive that information. It pops up on your screen. And then you can go and you can set up an FTP network for being able to distribute to the different computers in the EOC, say, for instance, where the emergency manager can look at the stuff and send messages back to go out and that kind of a thing. It's just fun stuff. It's just fun to play with. And it's we even did a whole presentation and invited our emergency manager. She thought it was great. She thought,
so, but you, but the thing of it is, though, is it is fun. It is a lot of fun doing this stuff. It isn't just real serious curmudgeon work, you know, where you're you're standing there with the axe and the big hammer busting rocks. In other words, this is fun stuff. This is creative stuff, and I think a lot of times, in different areas of the country, especially where I live, emergency communications is depicted as being, oh, I don't know, David, you live here. How would you describe it?
There ain't nothing fun about it. It's all straight down to business, all Robert's rules of order.
Yeah, you know, it's it.
Well, I see a difference. Well, actually, both of you are right, because the idea is once. You know, hams, we have two hats we have to wear. We can have the fun stuff where we're kind of laid back on the air, and, you know, we don't want to make a should I say this? We don't want to make a CB band out of it, so we don't want to get too crazy. But we can be laid back and we can be casual on the local repeater. But when the time comes to fall into business, I mean, we do have to have a certain amount of, you know, structure there, because I mean, it only takes one incident and one person for an emergency management team to say, "We don't want you guys here anymore. You guys are a bunch of,
y'all are crazy." You know,
yeah, or you know, you just go in to a situation with the opinion that, you know, here I am, I'm the Billy Bad Dude communicator. You need me. What do you, you know?
Okay, well, that's the distinction. And what I'm saying is, I think hardcore emergency communication, where you're actually doing and serving a need, I believe that is something very much fun to do. I think it's very satisfying. It makes a person feel like they're accomplishing something, but I think it's fun. And I'm not defining fun as craziness. What is craziness are the over-serious curmudgeons that come on the scene. And we got a little bit of time left. David, I don't know if you remember this, but we had a big fire, a big explosion, a propane explosion that took place near Hartsville. And we didn't know what it was. There obviously was no radio net. We had actually tried to get Trousdale County involved, or a net involved for Trousdale County, but we had a radio Hitler that was controlling all of ARES and everything. And, you know, what he says goes, and he liked to play God, okay? Yeah. So, and that's what really spoiled it for a lot of people. But we drove out of curiosity out to find out what this big, huge flame was, and it was way up in the air. We got there, our local sheriff was there, and we stopped, and he recognized me because I worked in the radio business, and he was teasing the both of us because we had antennas on the car, and he said, "Well, are you guys going to get your orange jumpsuits out and start bossing us around and telling us what to do?" Okay, and that was his impression of what was going on locally with emergency amateur radio communications, you know, and I said, "No." I said, "I appreciate your humor in this," but I said, if we were to do anything as radio amateurs, we would be here as servants, and we would be here to take orders and do whatever you needed to step and fetch. It doesn't matter what, you know, we're not here to lead the way because we're not law enforcement. We're just amateurs, you know, which I think made a statement to him, but I hear what you're saying, but I still think that it's depicted, emergency, hardcore emergency communications is not depicted as being, I guess I want to say, as fun an experience as it is, because I think it's a fun experience. It's a learning experience. It is a social experience. It's a human experience. And all of those things make it a really, really cool thing to be involved in. Now, that's how I see it. Now,
I don't disagree.
You know, I mean, it's